Dr. Rob, I know you've taken out thousands of implants. How many of them are truly infected?
We found that 29% actually have bacterial contamination found on PCR testing.
It's a bacterial infection. What type of bacteria is it?
Staph epidermidis. And
so there's no safe implant. It's impossible.
Not that's been made thus far.
Even if it's from nature.
There's only autologous, which is your own tissue. Everything else, unless it's your genetically identical twin, has to have a level of immunosuppression for you to be able to keep it. Otherwise, it's going to get rejected if it's an organ. If it's a prosthesis, your body's going to form a collagen bag around it to try to get it out.
What about lip, like blowing your lips up?
All the filler things are interesting because...
Dr. Rob, you said 29% of breast implants are infected. How is that even possible?
There's three ways to get it. They give you a contaminated implant. They contaminate it and give it to the surgeon, contaminate it, and they put it in. Then the surgeon could contaminate it. Those are the two most unlikely ways to get contamination. The third is...
Dr. Robert Whitfield, welcome to the show. This is a long time coming. We've been crossing paths and I've been wanting to have this interview with you. It's near and dear to my heart. So many of my friends have been sick from breast implant illness. And then after explant surgery and removal, life changed, hormones come back online. They're kinder, nicer. Like there's a real thing here and you're an expert. You are the expert when it comes to this. And let's help some people today.
First of all, I think it's great that we're able to do this today. We're actually in Scottsdale at a meeting together, and it's worked out that we're going to be able to talk about this. So I look at breast implant illness as chronic inflammation, of which a breast implant is playing a role. And much like many of the friends, family members, loved ones you may have encountered who had this problem and explanted, many of them do well right away. Mm-hmm. So we already know about 29% of those patients that I explant have a bacterial contamination or underlying infection mm-hmm. on their implants. So when you remove them, mm-hmm. you remove a tremendous source of stimulation to their immune system. And then, like you mentioned, things can come back online or reset or however we want to view that, whether it's hormonally, mm-hmm. Energy levels, things that... from a gut standpoint, maybe off. Mm-hmm. Many of those things respond right away. And the other instance where I find that happening is when there's leaching from the implants. One of my patients, Lauren Bostick, from the Skinny Confidential, looked at her toxicity burden test and she had a whole page of heavy metals. Mm. And so she would go into a sauna, a barrel sauna at about 212 degrees Fahrenheit and sit in there for 60 to 90 minutes. So she was basically, she joked she was melting her implants. And we said that on our show and I got accused of an ethics violation. But the chemical process, the actual process is leaching chemicals out of the implants, just as if we stuck a plastic water bottle in a car and let it overheat and the phthalates would come out into the water.
And antimony, by the way, I did a little study on that myself and it does leach antimony.
Right. So these are two, those are the two most common ways that people, mm-hmm. once I operate on them, within the short time after surgery, they are doing extremely well.
Yeah. It's life changing.
Yeah.
Man, there's so many places we could go, right? Because, you know, there's moral, ethical, there's toxicity with breast implants. There's the fact that there's a time and a place for a breast implant. Do you still put breast implants in? Like that topic isn't talked about much, and you have to, you know, work your way around it because everyone has freedom of choice when it comes to this. That's, is there a safe breast implant? Is it are they safe for the first 5 years? Is it 6 years? Like, there's a shelf life. Like, when is there a time and a place for a healthy breast implant? And what about putting, you know, your own fat in? A lot of friends are doing that.
Right. So that's the...
not close friends.
The big question is, like, is there, you know, for your audience listening, they should understand a little bit about my background. So I trained in general surgery for 6 years. I did plastic surgery for 2 years. I did a reconstructive microsurgery fellowship for an additional year. So 9 years after I got done with medical school, I finally went into practice. Mm-hmm. And then in practice for 7 years, I just did oncologic reconstruction predominantly for head and neck cancer, breast cancer, sarcomas, which are tumors of muscle, fat, and bone. And so during that time, I got very familiar with any kind of challenge, especially as it related to breast cancer, because it was so prevalent. Mm-hmm. That would be the most frequent one we did reconstruction for. And so I have patients coming in who predominantly wanted their own tissue used for reconstruction. That's called the DIP free flap. And that uses the tissue that's thrown away in a tummy tuck, leaves it attached to the blood vessels, and then you reconnect the blood vessels underneath the sternum, kind of like what the heart surgery we use for a vascular bypass. And that would revascularize the tissue, and you would have a natural breast reconstruction. So that's predominantly what I did. Now, in the country, our country, in the United States, it's so expansive. It's so big. I live in Texas, as you know, and you can fit in the entire country of Spain within the landmass of Texas. So for us in the United States, once you get outside of a larger urban area, say a million plus people, that access to care, the access to someone like me with that skill set drops off really quickly. So then you would not get offered that type of care because they wouldn't be able to, from a facility standpoint, the hospital, the nursing, and then you have the operators, like we've been talking about, the breast surgeons, the plastic surgeons. They have to have the requisite skill set and experience to deliver that kind of care. So I always worked in bigger centers that could do that.
So it's a lot easier to cut a little slit and shove in some silicone.
In this country, it's always going to be the dominant form of breast reconstruction, because in any community-based system, hospital, smaller area, they have to be able to execute the breast reconstruction, and that would be what they could do.
That
so
makes sense.
A typical expander implant breast reconstruction would be what would always get offered. And I didn't obviously do as many because I was doing the longer, more complicated case. But then what do you think happens when those got infected, meaning the implants got infected, or somebody got a radiation injury after treatment, or a capsular contracture, which is some hardening of the device, not the device, but the scar tissue around it. So then those people would get referred to us. So if you look back at my history, I was taking care of breast implant problems really from the start, because anytime you put a hip, knee, dental, breast implant, cardiac implant, neurologic implant, anybody, your body immediately tries to get rid of it.
Yeah, that's one thing, problem with surgery.
It rejects it.
Yeah, and any device.
Correct. So the only, and that's our body's immune system, and that's the concept of tolerance. So Joseph Murray was the last surgeon who won the Nobel Prize for basically doing a kidney transplant in Siamese twins. He could do that because they're genetically identical. They don't need immunosuppression.
All right.
And then later on, he went to become the first person to put a cadaver kidney in someone, and that needed immunosuppression.
Yeah, I have friends.
So that's really what we're talking about. So any implants,
whether it's someone else's tissue or
a prosthetic.
Yeah, prosthetic, yeah.
Is going to cause an immune reaction.
Right.
So when I take everything out and you let the analysis from the pathologist, it always says the same types of things. Chronic inflammation, and the cells are going to be giant cells and histiocytes. It's because your body's trying to get rid of them. So that happens to every single implant.
Everybody.
Yeah. There's nothing novel or new about this.
Right.
It's going to be that way for all time.
So it's low. It's like living in a moldy home. You're going to have low grade inflammation happening.
So that leads
for my prosthetic
to the next question. So you said mold. So I started out, and my entire training background is allopathic, of course, because I'm a surgeon. And then I subleased when I went into private practice solo from a functional medicine provider, and I started learning about all these things, and then working with his team when we had questions about nutrition or testing of other types of things like mold. For instance, you brought up mold. That always is, like, to me, it's one of the more crafty things that we don't get taught a lot about in medical school. We learn about fungal infections, but, like, it's a very common, very poorly understood problem.
And it's a big problem.
Huge problem. So in my patients, so I fundamentally have always been curious about genetics, the Genome Project, its application, and now you see the cost come down for whole genome analysis. So, you know, if you remember back to like 23andMe and all the things, right, they used to send you all this stuff and tell you how much of a Neanderthal you wore or weren't, or where you came from. But more importantly, like, everybody at this point has heard of the MTHFR gene, and it's lovely description. But there, it's just one of many methylations.
It is one that I just had another interview about that, and it's you know, oh, I run around, I have
MTHFR.
MTHFR.
Yeah.
I have the mother gene. And
exactly.
And you think your life's over, but there's all these other genes. And, you know, so don't, like, genetic testing, we won't go down the rabbit trail. That's not where we're talking. I want to keep on the...
Well, so that's the trail, right? Yeah. So if you don't methylate well,
yeah,
and you have maybe poor vitamin D mm-hmm. metabolism,
mm-hmm.
and you have a poor antioxidant pathway, mm-hmm. so oxidative stress, or somebody, I think if your cells are working really hard building up waste, if you can't detoxify it well, that's another problem. And then probably the final one, along with mold and heavy metals and environmental toxins, which we can talk about, is your glutathione pathway. Mm-hmm. So if you have a poor glutathione pathway and all those other ones I mentioned.
And you have breast implants.
And that, my friend, is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So in our patients, it's unpublished data. We submitted for a new IRB, but 83% of our patients have SNPs or problems in all of them. Where the general population, maybe 36% of the people have a methylation problem with MTHFR.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you keep stacking the dick,
yeah,
the deck, it that's the problem. So that's the person who has the most symptoms who comes to see Rob in Austin to have their implants removed. That's the worst possible scenario.
And that's almost like you have to. Otherwise, you're going to be really sick.
I don't listen to symptoms for the sake of making a diagnosis. I'm listening to symptoms to better understand how you as an individual detoxify. So you have mold-free coffee from Life Boost. We drink that.
Mm-hmm.
I talk to my patients about Zen, which is a mycotoxin associated with coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to reduce your exposures by improving your air quality with things like a Jasper, improving your coffee quality with like Life Boost coffee that's mold free, that's been tested. You have to be really careful about what you put into your system mm-hmm. and where you work, where you live. Like, these are the places we get exposed to these things all the time. And then over a time, your genetic capacity is exceeded. You can no longer cope and you get more and more symptomatic.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Your coffee cup overfills with toxins. And mm-hmm. if you have these weak genetics, which I do, you express a lot of crazy symptoms.
Yeah, very quickly, very easily.
And you don't want to function. You don't want to, you know, I didn't even want to live because it's just horrific. Your hormone dysregulation, yeah. you have mitochondrial dysfunction, all the things.
Yeah.
And so there's the genetic components. So let's get back to that. Our breast, in any capacity, are breast implants safe?
Well, the first breast implant was placed in Houston in 1962 and had a very thick silicone elastomer shell
mm-hmm.
and then a pretty thick filler. And they did their iterations to try to make them feel different. And now we're into the generations of implants. Some of them now have this new nanotexturing. So in general, when you place a device, it's going to react to you.
No matter what.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah, hip, knee, dental, breast implant, it does not matter. The thing is how you cope with everything else. Like you said, genetically, mm-hmm. environmentally, you know, those things have to remain. And I always use the word balance, maybe not the best analogy, but if you get out of balance, then you're going to have more and more problems.
Right.
So the safety as a device, you know, these things are going, they're not lifetime.
Yeah.
Let's just make that clear.
They have a shelf life.
Yeah, I always looked at cancer patients and cosmetic patients and said, hey, at year 8, barring any other things going on, we're going to discuss the longevity of this device and look at it, because the rupture rate goes up 0.5% per year annually after that. And the reason being is, like, you don't, like, just put it in and forget it. And that's, a lot of patients come to me with that.
Yeah, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. 40. I took out a pair of implants from the 60s in a 90-year-old.
Oh my
gosh. Recently.
Was she having health challenges?
They had bad capsular contracture, and she just lived that way for decades because that technology was inferior, you know. I mean, you're talking about the 60s.
That's amazing. I had no idea that people were getting breast implants way back.
1962, the first implant was placed in Houston, Texas by Dr. Cronin and Giroux.
So why was that back then? Why were they putting breast implants? Wasn't for beauty, was it?
So the initial, so breast augmentation has been done in some way, shape, or form with injectables like paraffin, which is obviously very dangerous and ultimately leads to granulomatous problems, necrosis.
So they inject paraffin. Paraffin wax.
Yeah. Paraffin would have to be heated to liquid form to be injected. That was the first injectable biomaterial. Then they used all sorts of things. And then liquid silicone after World War II, or towards the end of World War II, became vogue because the Japanese women were trying to be more attractive to the American GIs. So they were using liquid industrial grade silicone to be injected.
Just straight in.
Yeah. And so that leads to all sorts of granulomatous disease and problems and necrosis. That got banned basically in the Western world, but maintained in Asia for a long period of time. And then there's a series of sponges, and this seems a little bit weird, but the sponge had been used in medical care, especially in cancer surgeries, to reconstruct a defect, like fill a space, so to speak. So those had been used. And then one in particular called an Ivalon sponge was used. But just like we were talking about, you can get a bad scar capsule around it, really firm and hard. And that kind of next step led to the transition to between the sponges and the breast implants. But when I researched and tried to figure out how things were being developed, obviously Dow Corning is the manufacturer of the first devices, but you don't see any of the study information because it wasn't, you didn't have to have a study back then. It wasn't required.
They just stuck stuff in and we didn't know the consequences.
Correct. Yeah.
So this is similar to a tattoo. A tattoo causes an autoimmune reaction. There's no way around it. And it's a cost benefit analysis. It's going to cause low grade inflammation, probably less so than a breast implant, but it's, every time you get a tattoo, low-grade inflammation, the more you have. But if you're healthy, it's the trade-off, you know?
Right. And so the other thing that's probably a little bit hard for patients is they feel just like an explant's going to solve everything.
Right.
And so we built a program around the concept that that's not really the main focus. And I look at everybody's genetics and we look at their toxicity burden, and things like DDA and DDP and DDEPTH, all these pesticides are extremely prominent in this country, especially in Florida. And if you grew up around things like golf courses, then atrazine is definitely in your system. And I'm sure if people follow you and listen to you, they know what atrazine is. But all these different either herbicides, pesticides, glyphosates from, you know, all this stuff I see all the time in patients. And it's not the heavy metals that you would think, oh, they're coming out of the shell all the time. That's not the dominant thing that we see. We see predominantly those herbicides, pesticides, and then we see mycotoxins.
So you're not just looking at when you're getting people well. This is, now I think I'm getting it. You are not just removing their explant. You're not just removing the device.
Right.
You're testing for all these other environmental toxins, not just the pro-inflammatory implant. And this is the difference of, you're not just saying, hey, we're going to take your explants. You're going to have an explant surgery.
Right.
And then your life's going to be normal. But what you're realizing is there's a lot of other toxins that are in their body that are hindering them from having a recovery.
Yeah, I think what everyone needs to understand is obviously I was taught a certain way with allopathic medicine, and we've heard different people, whether it's Peter Attia or someone, talk about medicine 3.0, whatever they think that is. Mm-hmm. I actually practice full-time. I see patients every day and I operate on them, have been for almost 30 years now. And the point is blending what we know about genetics and things that we learn in biohacking, things that we understand from functional medicine testing or whatever we're deriving, we always should use the best information to help the patients.
Right.
Like if you're coming to me and tell me your CRP is high, I'm like, well, you're fucked up, because CRP is an older than I am biomarker. Mm-hmm. Like, if you've got a high CRP, you have a real legit problem that needs to be addressed. And that may be something wrong with your liver. There may be some other infection. Maybe you have something else going on. That does not resonate with me, because I've looked at this over time, and that is not what I see in my patients.
Right.
My patients have specific genetic alterations in their ability to detoxify what they're exposed to. When you're exposed to all these herbicides and pesticides, or molds, or heavy metals, or X, your body can't cope with them. That affects your gut health. So we look at gut testing. We look at other sensitivities in their diet, like real sensitivities. I don't put people on elimination diets because I think they're cruel and they're usual punishment. I try to identify what's triggering them and get out of their diet. They don't have to live without it forever. But during this period where you're trying to get me to take you through a procedure to get you to recover and feel better, the best thing to do is just listen to the product. I've done this on thousands of patients now. And uniformly, they'll recover better if prepared properly, right, and taken through a procedure and then helped afterwards. So we have health coaches and functional providers to help them on the back end as well as the front end. A really devoted anesthesia team to provide ultrasound guided nerve blocks and use the least amount of anesthesia or the best strategies to help them recover. Like, this is the way I think we should just be doing things in general, but we've just applied it to our surgical practice and try to continue to tweak it, make it better. The first book, Sharp, is about my methodology for this. And then the second book is about breast implants, explant surgery and breast implant illness, to really just let everybody know, like, we're not hiding anything. I've published books about it. I have people copying my system now all over the country, which is fine.
Yeah, good.
It's great. It'll help patients. And I don't, like, yeah, people send me messages, oh, they're using your system. Great. You're actually doing the right thing.
You're following the protocol.
Yeah, you're doing the right
thing. And I love what you're doing, because you're not, you could just say, hey, I'll take your breast stuff out, right? I'll get rid of the silicone, whatever device you have in there, and be on your way. And they still remain sick, because
Which happens, and
your moral and ethical obligation is, okay, they're coming to me sick. The reason they're coming to me sick, it's not just their breast implants.
Right.
It's all these other things. And you're like, well, if you want to get well, we got to prepare your body to remove these toxins. We got to get you healthier, lower your inflammation, anti-inflammatory diet. Let's move these out. Let's start working on your gut. Let's prepare you to truly have a healthy healing journey. So people who get sick from breast implants, is you're just using, in a good way, you're using their challenge that they're focused on the breast implant. So they're coming to you, and then you decide, well, let's do it the right way. Let's do the
correct.
Why I went to medical school is to get people all the way well. So you help them from the beginning, prep them, have the surgery, and then make sure they're doing all the things. So essentially, you're like a high-end detox coach, functional medicine doctor
Mark Hyman said I sound like a functional medicine doctor. It's like, I just sound like what I always talk about is just trying to do the right thing. It's not convenient to do what we do at all.
No, you could, exactly. I actually got excited. I'm like, I didn't know this. Like, I didn't know how dedicated you were to your craft and to actually helping people get well. I was a sick guy, right? And you could say, hey, just get your mercury amalgam fillings out, dentist.
Right.
Right. And they could do it incorrectly. And make people more sick,
right,
or they can follow a correct protocol,
right,
and help people. But what they really need to do is, at least for a month, prepare them for that removal, because they're going to have mercury exposure. They have to do everything they possibly can during the surgery to not just expose the doctor, but also the patient to mercury vapor and all the things. There's lots of ways to do it. And then afterwards, you have to support their body to get that crap out for them to recover. And you're doing that. It's like breasts, implant, explants is like the amalgam fillings of the, So you're doing the same thing, like a functional dentist.
Right.
You're a functional surgeon.
It's very similar.
People are coming to you. They know that these are toxic, but you're saying, yes, this is toxic. I'm going to remove your amalgam filling. It's hazardous waste in your mouth. But you're saying, look, but if I'm going to do this, let's do it right. Right. You're not giving them a miracle.
You can't actually engage with me if you don't follow the program, because I don't really need to operate on folks for the sake of operating. I don't find that serves them.
No.
It's just like you said about the dentist. I mean, I'm very aligned with our biologic dentist colleagues, and I've had them on my show, and I'm sure you've had a bunch on your show. And when they do it the correct way, the patients can really get on the right track. Now, there'll be other things, other challenges they all face, like we all do. And you just try to set them up to have as much success as possible with their recovery process. Because if you get them started properly before surgery and then do surgery and execute all the steps and or dentistry, and then you put them on the proper detoxification pathway and help them through the process, then you're actually going to get some amazing transformations. But if you don't, you definitely won't.
And that's the dopamine spike. Doing what you do is seeing people get well. I've been doing this a long time and used to sit knee to knee and seeing moms bring in their child that, you know, needed to put a colostomy bag on them and be like, what can you do for my daughter? She's on 3 meds. I'm like, let's put her on an anti-inflammatory diet. Let's give her some butyrate. Work with an MD to get some butyrate enemas. Let's lower that inflammation. Here's what the research says, how it helps colitis. And then you see the fissure in their daughter's anus heal. And then their whole family heals because they're all following the diet as well. And you're just like, wow, like that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
To see people who.
But that's very educational to your point. Like you have to educate
them. Yeah, you have to educate. You got to take time. You got to educate. You got to show them that they have the capacity to be their own doctor through the educational process. Absolutely love what you're doing, man. I loved you before. I love you so much more now. Because it's refreshing, right? Because so many people, you know, you get something that's in vogue, like, hey, explant surgeries are becoming really popular.
Yes.
And you could cash in on that. And a lot of people are like, sure, I'll take them out. You know, here's the bill. We'll even bill your insurance.
Put them in, take them out. It's an annuity.
Yeah. It's just like every other
knee
replacement where you could just do PRP probably, you know, or stem cells.
Yeah.
You know, and then you're going to, instead of putting, you know, plastic or Teflon or ceramic, whatever, it's still going to react and cause problems. Here's a big question that I have, and I want to ask you some other questions as well, but silicone.
Yeah.
It's toxic. People say silicone is non-toxic. It's relatively an inert material, but it's not silica. It contains something called siloxanes, which are carcinogenic.
Yeah.
And they're released at a relatively low temperature in the studies. I think as low as 180 degrees Fahrenheit, not at high levels by no means. You're definitely getting a lot of other toxic exposures.
Right.
Have you ever measured for siloxanes in people's blood or?
No, we haven't.
Be interesting.
It would be, you know, I get asked routinely because people will have lymph nodes, especially if they've ruptured a device. They'll have lymphadenopathy or swollen lymph nodes, and they will have been told on a scan, whatever diagnostic study, that they have silicone in their nodes, and they want to know, can I take the lymph node out, or can that get detoxified from them? And the short answer is, for everybody listening, if you're going to undergo explant surgery and you have a rupture and you've had silicone identified lymph nodes in the axilla or somewhere else, don't ask the surgeon to go then take out that node. That's not the right answer. Mm-hmm. That can lead to lymphadenopathy, and lymphedema. And you don't want to risk that. So what I tell patients always is, obviously, if the device is ruptured, and we know this preoperatively, we try to get them scheduled relatively soon and get things organized for them, because I don't like to hear a breast cancer patient, a cosmetic patient, any kind of situation that somebody's got a ruptured, malfunctioning device, right? Mm-hmm. You want to get that out. Now, as it relates to detoxification, we've currently used vendors like Cellcor and Quicksilver for detoxification protocols that are more holistic in nature, and then not really resulted to much in the way of chelation therapy in my practice. Mm-hmm. We tried the other avenues first.
Yeah, like DMPS, DMSA.
Very simple things, oral things, so that people don't develop or have problems with Herxheimer reactions. I have a lot of patients get that if they get going too quickly. Mm-hmm. So we try to be very intentional and very conservative but safe in our approach afterwards. Because the patients want to rush sometimes. They start feeling better. They want to do more, which is fine. But some people really struggle with Herxheimer type reactions. So they get flu-like symptoms. They feel run down.
Yeah.
And you have to really protect them from themselves at that point.
Yeah, take them low and slow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I have a patented detox support crystal, if you will, that I haven't even really talked. I've never talked about on my show.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, I don't. You know, just I'm not a a lot of folks oversell things, and they
yes.
they say that binders do everything, and,
right?
You know, but certain
which of binders, course is not true.
Yeah, certain binders are good at certain things. Other binders are good at other things. A lot of them are contaminated, so I wanted to stand out and have the Lamborghini, you know, liposomal, you know, and I'm friends with all of those other companies.
Yeah.
A lot of them have
yeah.
actually learned from us over yeah. the years. And so I'm excited. I just did a small, you know, internal, be careful how I say it, like, but study with 10 clients in a medical practice. And we saw some amazing results
okay.
That I can talk to you more about.
Sure, sure.
And yeah, so I didn't even know that you were doing the heavy metals and detoxification support to that level. So that's really exciting. I'd like to work with you and run some studies, you know, on how to say it properly, but and to see how much some support some of these outcomes. Because for me, you have to be very careful when it comes to,
yes.
For example, chlorella. You know, I'm a low temperature aqueous geochemist. We use binders in the environment to help people, to help the planet. And a lot of those mechanisms, if it can bind in the environment, you know, does it bind in your body? You got to be careful how you say those
sure.
things.
Yeah.
But chlorella, for example, is a very weak binder. It's a great antioxidant,
mm-hmm.
but it's a very weak binder, and it can stir up toxins in yeah. your body because it's not permanent, right? It's not a magnet. It's almost like metal that's not magnetized, but it has a slight, you know, it's slightly magnetic, and
yeah.
it's easy to knock it off. It's not surrounding it. So we'll talk about that off, you know, after this podcast, but detox support binding type agents is one of those things I've been doing for a very long time, and it's been very misplayed.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So it's super sad. But I like, you know, I've used DMSA, DMPS. I think they can be very effective.
Mm-hmm. Once again, we don't see as much heavy metal as you would think we should.
You see a lot of mycotoxins, you're saying.
Yes, I see a ton of mycotoxins. And I would really like providers, if they're listening to this, and clients who listen to this, who go to their providers that are told that mycotoxins do not matter, that's absolutely, categorically false.
Mm-hmm.
Mycotoxin burden is no joke. It does affect your mitochondrial function. In my patients who have so many genetic SNP problems, mutations, it's absolutely a huge driver of problems. And I will not do, you mentioned fat transfer. So I've done fat transfers since, I've moved fat around since the 90s. But in earnest, since we'll say 2002, 2004, something like that. And I've done thousands of them. And they work provided a very specific set of criteria are met. You know, we're talking about somebody being healthy, like sleeps, eats well, doesn't have contaminated fluids go into their system or foods go into their system. And then when you look at their toxicity burden, you basically want it as low as possible, and meaning no heavy metals in a significant amount, no mycotoxins, especially in a significant amount, and none of these herbicides or pesticides, because all these things affect, if you think of like all the things mold affects.
Oh, it's crazy. Every aspect of your body.
Yeah, and I have to
neurology. It's a neurotoxin. It's pro-inflammatory. It's hormone mimicking. It's carcinogenic. It's
and we're trying to heal somebody yeah. after surgery. I'm taking something from somewhere and I'm putting it somewhere else. So it has to be I always say it like this. Okay, it's the right place, the right time, right person, right space. Right. So if I take fat from the best stem cell component for fat in general is inner thigh, if you have enough lower inner thigh fat. or upper inner thigh fat. That being said, like, you have to go get this fat, right? You have to acquire it a certain way and protect it. Then you have to put it back. Now, where are you going to put it back? If you're doing a Brazilian butt lift, you don't want to go in the muscle. You want to stay above the muscle. And there's different layers of fat in that area. But just in general, you have to be in the right place, right? Fat wants to be with its friends, I say. So put it in the fatty compartment. You don't stick it in the breast. It'll create cysts. It'll create radiographic abnormalities that will cause concern for cancer during any kind of screening or ultrasound for that matter. So you want to be beneath the skin, above the breast. That's the fatty plane. We all have it. So that's where it belongs. And it's a very, very good procedure. What it can't do, its limitation is projection. An implant can give you projection because of its density and inability to be compressed. So an implant can press out. That's what it does. But it also looks incredibly unnatural if you just think about the aesthetics. All of a sudden you have this huge upper pole. That's not normal. And it's sticking way out. Well, that's not normal either. That's not a natural appearance. But when you put fat in and layer it out over the existing breast form, it situates the existing form. It just makes it fuller. Doesn't really create some wildly abnormal shape because it can't. It's a natural filler. It's the natural filler in existence. Has been since time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you just have to be able to move it around in the right place at the right time. But for our patients who have a lot of toxicity and they want to have this transformation, they want to expand, they don't feel well, but they don't want to lose the aesthetic completely of what's been done. I'm empathetic and understand that, but it has to be at the right time. I can't have somebody with a high mycotoxin burden and all these other herbicides, pesticides, environmental toxins and or heavy metals in their system. And I can't recover somebody, get them on the right track and get all this healed with all that going on.
And you're adding in another insult, another surgery, right. And then fat cells.
They have to heal.
They heal first so they can take another hit.
So if you're transferring burden from one place to another, so to speak, it's not helping.
For everyone listening, you know, when you get overwhelmed with toxicity, it stores them. It's like putting crap in your closet.
Right.
And those toxins, and this is what's in the literature, it stores them in fat cells. And so if you're messing with those and you're taking toxic cells that are probably moving towards autophagy and turning into, because the cells, if they're toxic, they're going to want to die and replicate.
Right.
And then you get, which ages you, by the way, toxins are one of the fastest way to age your body. So that's why, you know, what you're doing is it's anti-aging of sorts, because when you lower someone's toxic burden.
Oh, I'm glad you said that. We should say that again. So what is aging then? What do you think aging is?
You're asking me a question. It's my podcast. Just kidding. What do I think aging is? I've never even thought about it, but let me just go off the cuff. What is aging? In general, I think aging is your cells can only replicate so many times. And so if you don't have healthy cells, you is what causes you to age. So it's a time clock of what is causing your cells to continue to replicate, to become a healthy cell, and trying to eliminate the things that are making it trying to survive and try to express its the healthiest cell possible. So aging is the lack of, anti-aging is the lack of the things that cause aging. And aging is exposing yourself to toxins, trauma, stress, poor diet, other insults, anything toxic that will drive that aging process much more quickly.
And so when I look at it for our patients, I don't think of it from the levels that I would say from the interactions. Like, I recently had a patient travel from Florida for surgery, and we reviewed her toxicity tests. And the reason it's top of mind is she had all these pesticides in her system, and she was having cognitive symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So she had memory loss. And so what do we all want to avoid? We want to preserve our brains. We want to avoid Alzheimer's and dementia. we don't want to fall, so we want to maintain our strength. You know, we don't want to have a heart attack, so we want to have we want to have poor heart health or good heart health. So we want to diminish inflammation in all these different organ systems, right? I think inflammation is a thing that's going to end us.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the sneaky things we'll say is nobody kind of thinks about your brain health. One of the most unfortunate things I find in my patients is obstructive sleep apnea in really young people.
Mm-hmm.
It affects women differently because you and I as males typically will snore. They don't. They may have central sleep apnea and they'll wake up just gasping. And you may not even know because both you and I snore or you know, I use the CPAP. So I encourage patients to get that checked because the last thing you want to do is have early onset Alzheimer's or dementia. And then as it relates to things like you were mentioning like cellular health, all of it ends up that our organs age at different rates. And each organ clock is slightly different. Mm-hmm. And we just want to lower the inflammation in the systems to age in the most healthy, graceful way possible.
Yeah. And that's why I think breast implants, pesticides, herbicides, all these toxins drive inflammatory process, drive autophagy.
Yeah.
Not healthy autophagy.
No, but, not really.
Cellular senescence.
Yes, all the big words.
Yeah, all the big words. So, Rob, should everybody get the breast implants out?
No, we don't feel like that's the route everybody should take.
Mm-hmm.
It's indicated if people can, demonstrate they're so symptomatic and without, you know, a proper medical workup or an anti-inflammatory diet or the right supplementation or evaluation that they just aren't improving. And then we'll definitely talk to them about X-Play.
So the surgery itself could make them sicker.
Yeah, we don't want to put anybody through surgery if they're not worked up properly, because that can make them worse.
Right. So if someone's healthy with the implant,
mm-hmm.
and they're watching this right now, I'm healthy, I love my beautiful implants, they're 5 years old, what would you tell that person?
Yeah, I think you need to monitor them.
Yeah.
Like we discussed. And then everybody experiences inflammation, as we've discussed, differently.
Mm-hmm.
And even though you don't feel bad or you're not having symptoms, you have inflammation because you have a foreign body in your system. That's beyond question. Now, how you cope with it, how you deal with it is a function of how you metabolize your toxins, how much you get exposed to. So you always have to keep that in the back of your mind.
Is there any testing that you could do to determine whether C-reactive implants are having an effect, like C-reactive protein, homocysteine? Is there any biomarker that would indicate to an individual, maybe these breast implants are causing an inflammatory response in my body?
Right. To date, there's no one specific biomarker that's commercially available, but oxylipin-10-HOME is a biomarker that we've introduced to the scientists and different companies
mm-hmm.
that once commercially available would indicate you're experiencing like a staph epi biofilm interaction, but that's not commercially available.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we focus on looking at genetics,
mm-hmm.
looking at toxicity burden. We look at gut health, food sensitivities, hormonal balance to try to craft a picture to let us better understand each individual, what they're experiencing, along with their listening to their symptoms and how they're feeling.
Dr. Rob, I know you've taken out thousands of implants. How many of them are truly infected?
Yeah, we found that 29% actually have bacterial contamination found on PCR testing. Everybody remembers from the pandemic how sensitive PCR testing. So 29% actually have bacterial contamination, not fungus. It's not mold. Stop writing about that. Stop talking about it.
It's the black stuff that they show in videos isn't black mold. No. It's stachybotrys on your implants. It's a bacterial infection. What type of bacteria is it?
Staph epidermidis, Cutibacterium acnes, both found in high concentrations on the skin and especially face, neck, chest.
So it's showing up on their external microbiome?
So that's where Cutibacterium acnes is most predominantly found. And then staph epi, of course, is found all throughout our skin.
Yeah. So when that's out of balance, why is that dangerous?
And so I think, like, if you look at me, I've probably got the worst skin microbiome you could find because I took care of cancer patients, burn patients, critically ill patients forever. And no matter how careful I would have been exposed to far more than you would have been had you not been in the same environment. So it's our own skin pathogens that become detrimental to us, and it can contaminate us. So if we get a cut on our skin, it gets inflamed, gets infected, that gets in our bloodstream, that ultimately will attach to a device.
Dr. Rob, you said 29% of breast implants are infected. How is that even possible?
Right. So the of all the explants I've done, 29% show bacterial contamination. So there's three ways to get it. They give you a contaminated implant, right? They contaminate it and give it to the surgeon, contaminate it, and they put it in. Then the surgeon could contaminate it. Those are the two most unlikely ways to get contamination. Mm-hmm. The third is somehow throughout our lives, we get bacteria in our bloodstream, maybe a cut, maybe an infection, a pneumonia. That then circulates in our bloodstream and attaches to the surface of the implant because our immune system cannot surveil the surface of an implant. Hip, knee, breast, dental cannot control that.
So it comes and finds a home.
Correct. And they like to bring their friends. They form colonies, and that's bacterial biofilm.
And that causes?
So that'll lead you to interaction with the breast tissue and development of that biomarker we talked about, oxylipin 10 home. And that has been shown to be higher in patients who are more symptomatic with breast implant illness.
So individuals that have more biofilms, little colonies that are hiding from your immune system on this synthetic toxin, essentially low-grade toxin, are now causing chronic inflammation because they're fighting. Like, how does that?
Yeah, it causes oxidation, right? We want to be in a reduced state.
Right.
So the bacteria interact with oleic acid in the breast tissue. Mm-hmm. It oxidizes. That's an oxylipin. This one is called oxylipin 10 home. And it goes downstream through multiple reactions to cause macrophage polarization. Mm-hmm. And that's what stimulates the increased amount of symptoms. Think of like joint pain, muscle pain, shortness of breath, all sorts of fatigue problems.
Flu-like symptoms.
That's where you're getting, those are all the symptoms of chronic inflammation.
So what are the top three symptoms of breast implant illness?
It's always going to be some level of fatigue and or brain fog, or think of like memory loss. And then I always, you know, joint pain is a common one. And then something that's probably thought of infrequently as not a big deal, but skin type rashes or eczema, or frequently referred to as atopic dermatitis.
So skin problems.
Yeah. Yeah. Skin's the largest organ of the body.
Just to finish this up for my own curiosity. So you're altering breast implants can indirectly alter your microbiome, because if you're getting these biofilms and colonies, they're obviously can they release into your bloodstream and affect the rest of your microbiome? Or is it more of an indirect relationship?
Yeah, so that's, I think the direct interaction is the interaction. Think of like the scar capsule, which is your collagen that forms around any device placed, hip, knee, breast, dental, implant, whatever it is, your body immediately walls it off and forms a collagen sac around it. Now, that is not a bomb shelter. It's not impervious. It's not going to withstand a nuclear attack. It's more like your Nana quilted something and you pull it apart and you can look right through it. Now that allows the tissues to interact with the bacterial contaminant. Now that interaction, the oxidative reaction in the breast with oleic acid is what leads to oxylipin 10 home, which is the bad actor. That then causes the macrophages to change and polarize. That leads to the symptomology. So it's really, not so much the release into the bloodstream, because if that happened, I think this would be easy. Mm-hmm. People would get sick as shit, red breast, swollen breast, in the hospital, sick, got to take it out. Now, when I did only predominantly oncology surgery, you know, infrequently, I'd get called Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Hey, this patient was getting chemotherapy. All of a sudden, they have a red, swollen breast after breast reconstruction. So that's infected. There's no question. That patient has to go to the operating room. If they can't resolve it with 24 hours of IV antibiotics, which typically they can't, and that has to be removed because that has become a source of sepsis for the patient.
So people who have breast cancer keep their implants in?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's when we were talking about in the beginning, a breast reconstruction done with an implant. So they had a mastectomy and a simultaneous reconstruction.
Okay, got it.
That would be the initial phase would be typically an expander, which is temporary, and that would be switched to a permanent implant later. But many times they have to go through chemotherapy and radiation therapy, And those patients are always at higher risk for infections or problems secondary to their treatments.
Out of all the types, there's lots of different, you know, Corning's making them, and, you know, everyone's making different types of breast implants.
There's only, the vendors now are Mentor and Allergan. Sientra was sold to another company, and there's a new one in the U.S. market called Motiva. It doesn't matter what type of implant manufacturer you're discussing. Anytime you're putting a foreign body in anybody, it's no different than the, you know, knee prosthetic manufacturers. I mean, there's nothing that's perfectly inert that's not going to react to your body. And some people really react more so than others. That's our individuality, right? And we talked about tolerance. And so, you know, your ability to tolerate that placement of that device is what ultimately will lead you to me or not lead you to me.
Yeah. So there's no safe implant. It's impossible.
Not that's been made thus far.
Yeah. I mean, even if, like you were saying earlier, even if you got a kidney.
Unless it's your genetically identical twin, that kidney is going to require a level of immunosuppressant. Think of like a steroid, like prednisone. And that's the way you can keep it.
So even if it's from nature, say it was a natural material, say it was a...
your body would recognize it for it and reject it.
There is no natural, safe, inert.
There's only autologous, which is your own tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, unless it's your genetically identical twin, has to have a level of immunosuppression for you to be able to keep it. Otherwise, it's going to get rejected if it's an organ. If it's a prosthesis, they're going to form, your body's going to form a collagen bag around it to try to get it out.
What about lip, like blowing your lips up?
Yeah, all the filler things are interesting because initially they were taught as they'll just disintegrate basically over time. They'll dissipate, but on MRI, you can actually see it in the tissues now. And so I think you have to, be very cautious with all the things you put into and onto your body. Because you never know which thing is going to really be a problem for you specifically, right? I don't have a specific battery of tests that I can give any individual to tell them, if you put this in, you're going to react a lot. Now, some people are doing more testing as it relates to metals and silicone, like you discussed earlier, especially as in the dentistry world, there's a lot of this now. A lot of people are getting more porcelain done because that's less of an issue.
Less reactive.
Yeah.
Breast implants, no matter where they're manufactured, carry risks. Why is that?
Right, because it's a foreign body. Your body's going to recognize it and try to wall it off, build a little collagen sac wall around it. And over time, it's going to still stimulate your immune system. It's not inert. It's not like it doesn't react. It doesn't matter what surface it is, smooth or textured. They're all going to react and stimulate your immune system.
So no matter what, it has some level of risk, some level of insult to your body. There's no safe implant.
No, they're all creating inflammation all the time.
Yeah. Would you say that a breast implant causes more inflammation than a tattoo?
Yeah, it's a bigger surface area if you think about how large it is. Yeah. They have a lot of surface area, and the textured ones have more surface area.
So they feel more natural.
They're not supposed to move as much.
So the textured ones may have more surface area, which may make them a little more pro-inflammatory.
Yeah, those are more pro-inflammatory in my experience, for sure.
Experientially, it's like, we're not saying that they are necessarily.
Yeah, in my experience, I see a lot of tissue reactivity, which makes sense because there's more interaction because of how it's designed.
So who makes those?
Each company has a version of texturing, for sure.
So textured implants may be a little more dangerous.
Those are the ones most closely associated with what's called breast implant associated anaplastic large cell lymphoma. And there's a particular type of texturing. So yes, those would be the more concerning. And so in my practice, when we did a cosmetic breast implant many, many years ago, we would always do a smooth implant, not a textured implant. And then really the textured were reserved for patients with more complicated reconstructive needs.
Can breast implants lead to cancer?
So that particular lymphoma is directly related to that textured breast implant. That's why there was a recall, and they would actually not And this is why, like, for cosmetic patients, there wasn't a lot of indications ever for me to personally put in a texture device. And once it was, you know, determined that that was a problem with this new breast implant associated anaplastic large cell lymphoma, I mean, there was no indication for me personally or professionally to use a texture device.
So, and but a doctor still putting these in?
They're not limited in the United States now. In Europe, in Asia, they've been banned.
Not in the U.S.?
No, they haven't banned them completely. They've sent out the letter to the patients that they have these devices, they're associated with this, that you need to be monitored.
Once again.
Right. They called it, the recall was to me because I am the actual purchaser of the device. Mm-hmm. Right. So then.
So you're going to call your patients and recall them in?
So, yeah. So one of the patients actually, who was a physician, came and we took their implants out that were a cancer patient. So, yeah, I've done that.
Yeah. Well, this has been a beautiful conversation. I love that you want to truly help and make a difference in this planet. How can people reach you?
Yeah, so the easiest thing right now, honestly, is to go to drrobertwhitfield.com. We enabled it with AI, so it's uploaded all of my podcasts, all of my books that I've done, and other shows or appearances I've made. So you can ask it questions. And then if you want to watch a video, there's a button.
That's great.
If you want to listen to something, you can listen to a show, or you can purchase a book or go to the store and learn about our options for programming for this, or supplementation for this, or whatever your desire is.
Yeah, I'd love that. So you give people the education so they can make an informed choice.
Yes.
Be their own doctor.
Yes.
How about that? So thanks for being on the show. I look
Thank
forward
you
to having you on again.